Log Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I'm on the road, literally hands-free, in a mobile radio show. We're literally heading west on our way to the Bloor Psychiatric Museum in St. Joseph, Missouri. And I'm hoping that you can hear me, and that if there's somebody out there who is waiting to talk, I can see there's somebody on the line. Just be sure to either try star one or just one to check in and to let me know. So I'm a little curious if you can hear me. If you can hear me, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. The toll-free line is area code 855-334-3651. Is that right? No.
855-346-3351.
Okay, so 855-346-3351 is the toll-free line if you need to call. And there are a couple of callers on the line. So anyway, I'm really excited about this trip to Missouri to go to the Bloor Psychiatric Museum. If you don't know about this place, you can check it out. They have a Facebook page. And they, you know, it started, some years ago. It's actually on the grounds of an institution. And there was a commissioner who wanted to shed light on the horrors that people were subjected to in earlier years of restraints and seclusion and all kinds of barbaric devices. And so they actually made replicas of some of these devices in order to educate the public about the horrors of psychiatry in the past. Now, I'm not sure if that was to make it seem as if the horrors of today aren't as bad as the horrors of yesteryear, and so that's always the question that we need to keep in mind as we go through this. But they do have a phenomenal, setup of different types of restraints, like the Utica crib, which was actually created at the Utica State Lunatic Asylum around the same time that the Opalians were writing the Opal in the 1850s. But when Utica State Lunatic Asylum was first set up, it was not supposed to have any restraints, and it was in response to the conditions being exposed about the poor in almshouses, of where we were literally, if you were deemed mad, you were literally, chained to walls, naked, given, bales of hay for beds in dungeons of the almshouses, of the poor houses, where people who were, financially struggling were going. But you weren't even allowed within their realm. You were, put down in the basement, so to speak. I think the Bloor Psychiatric Museum does a really good job of highlighting some of this. And then also at the same facility are the Black Archives. I'm hoping to be able to get in there and find out a little bit of what their archive holds also. But it's a little weird because, right behind this place, there's a prison it's my understanding, where there's death row, where inmates are waiting to be killed. And so while you have, on some level, people, trying to expose the horrors and barbaric nature of what was psychiatry in earlier centuries, or even earlier decades, right behind it, there's an active prison with a death row being just people waiting on death row. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-00. No, that's not it. It's 267-521-0167. And I am on the road tonight. It's been fine. I am on the road and actively moving forward, and so I'm hoping that maybe somebody can talk to me and tell me what's going on in the world, because I've been a little out of touch all day. And so I'm that's where it's at. One of my other goals in going to the museum is I'll be meeting with the curator, Sarah, who is really, I met with her last year, and she's really a very interesting woman, and done some interesting, has a lot of interesting ideas about how to educate the public about the history of psychiatry. And so in part, I'm trying to pitch the idea of an exhibit based on some of the findings of Dee Boyce, particularly around restraints and seclusion and electroshock and drugging, all of which the Bloor Psychiatric Museum has exhibits of. I think that's like one of the things that, you know, we don't really see too often is anybody who actually has exhibits of these things as problematic, as not. So I'm definitely excited about going there. Can you open area code 503 just in case there's a technical issue? Area code 503, your line is open if you have something that you'd like to talk about. Okay, I'm going to guess that you're just listening, and I'm going to turn it back down, and if you want to speak at any point, just press the 1 or star 1. And if you'd like to call in and talk, it's area code 267-521-0167. I also want to give up some updates about if you go to my Facebook page, Angela Vale, who called in last night, her YouTube page is Needing a Voice, and I did spend a little time today, not as much as I would like, and plan on doing more, watching some of the videos that she's put together, and particularly this one about the conversation with the nurse practitioner, where it comes to light that you know, that the wrongdoing that this nurse practitioner has done to Ms. Vail over time. And so I will be following up on that, and I'm hoping that through ectjustice.com or some other venue that a lawyer will be able to be found, because this is a clear multiple human rights violations occurring through this. And so, Angela, I'm glad that we're in touch, and I, you know, look forward to seeing how you go about getting justice for what happened to you and helping to make sure that this doesn't happen to other people. I think those are really important goals to have. Again, I'm on the road. I'm driving hands-free on a mobile radio show. So I'm not sure how long I'm going to keep this up tonight because I don't have my computer in front of me or things to read off or go by. But if you do want to call in, area code 267-521-0167. And if you have some interesting piece of information, something that has come up in recent times and you would like to give me some a tip or talk about something, totally open lines, It's all on you. I'm hoping that if you're online, and I see that there are several people online now, if you like talk, be sure to press 1 or star 1 in order to flag me so I know to pull you in to the conversation. And then, you know, also, like, this issue of the involuntary outpatient commitment and the Murphy Bill and H.R. 3717 and the Barber Bill and whatever backroom deals they're making amongst themselves to try to push this forward. I really mean what I said yesterday. I don't know how somebody sits in the position of a defendant when they have not currently done anything criminal or illegal or not even not complied with the psychiatrist and listen to somebody accusing them of being mentally ill and in need of being drugged without losing it. It is the most dehumanizing process. And then how after a psychiatrist testifies against you in court, mandating you to participate in treatment with this person, quote-unquote treatment with this person, how are you supposed to have any kind of trusting relationship to talk openly with somebody who would bring you to court to have you forcibly drugged? I really, you know, for anybody who is up against this and dealing with having to go through court and be in those halls and worry about what people are going to say about how you look or how you're acting or whether or not you, you know, smiled enough or too much or, you know, whatever. Have every behavior of yours investigated and under the microscope like that. I just give you so much credit because I would not, I fear if I ever had to be in that situation that I would not be able to hold myself together, that I would not be able to do that. And I think that this is a terrible thing that they're calling, and that the average person who knows nothing about psychiatric courts or, you know, that they can't even take you to court because of the way you're behaving based on somebody's testimony that isn't even necessarily relevant. I mean, even like, somebody's testimony of a doctor, you know, reading the notes of another doctor, all of a sudden now they try to sneak that in as legitimate testimony. I see area code 202 is online. I'm opening your line up, and 202, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, you're at the museum now?
No,
I just came in.
I'm on the road. I'm on the road. This is a legitimate mobile radio show tonight. So we're on the way to getting there. How's it sound? Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, you're coming through very well. It sounds like also there's who else is on? There's another. I sound like there's another person on. Is there someone else there, too?
Yeah.
No.
Hello?
You're working this logistics with me. You're driving a car?
I am driving, and
I'm helping her out with the logistics here.
Yeah, so we got Giovanni's on the studio, and I'm driving. I'm hands-free. I'm talking into the air.
I was worried for a while. You were driving.
Oh yeah, no. It's all good.
I'm handling everything. She's totally safe.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. So I think it's kind of cool that with this Bluetooth technology of this car rental, that we have the ability to broadcast live on the air, on the road.
Anywhere.
So I wasn't sure. Anywhere. Yeah, anywhere. This is what I want. I want a I want a mobile radio station, and I want to go meet people all over the country and talk to them. That's what I want to do.
Well, I was impressed on the last night's. I was impressed, but I also was sad from last night's caller that called in. It really had had some horrific things to happen to her. I'm quite sure that when you go to that museum, you're going to see some, well, usually these museums sometimes they don't put the spin on what really happened in the place. They try to make it very nice. I went last week. They have a museum at St. Elizabeth, but most of the time it's not open. It's only open during several hours, and I went in there, and one of the residents of the hospital gave a little tour of the place, and it kind of cleaned things up a little bit. But at least the resident of the hospital had gave us a little spin on the life of people in the past in the place. So I'm looking forward to hearing your report about the museum there.
Yeah, I'm really interested to see what new exhibits they have. And, you know, I got to tell you, like, there's an honesty about what's gone on. I mean, they have like, the colonic tables from when people used to be forced to have colonics before they would, like, rip out their insides and the big pill. And the big pill makers, and they have, there was this one exhibit that I thought was really interesting about, like, the colors of the Prozac advertising and the Thorazine advertising. The actual colors aimed at the doctors and the color schemes were almost identical. And so they pointed at things like that, but then they also have, like, you know, the Utica crib, which is, like, an adult size. Crib with a wooden flat top that people are locked in. So it's kind of hard to, like, walk away. Yeah, a cage. And so it's kind of hard to walk back from that and position it in any way other than, like, this was a problem. And they do have also an electroshock exhibit, which I thought was really interesting. And that's actually, you know, one of the times that it, like, really hit me that on the actual ECT machine is also an EEG machine, and so that where they're measuring your brain waves at the same time that they're shocking you, and to, like, have seen it, so up close was really, another way in which they try to make this, like, a medical thing and wipe it over as if it's not. And then they also have, like, a replica of the fever cabinet when they had said that, you know, because there was a period of time when a lot of people who were locked up in institutions, what they were saying they were suffering from was psychosis brought on by syphilis. And so at the time, the prior treatment was that every institution would keep somebody who had malaria on the unit so that they would be able to inject malaria into people, which would then cause a high fever, which would then, counteract syphilis. And after they stopped doing it, how disturbing is that, right?
What is it?
So, The old asylums, when they were state hospitals in the 1920s, 1930s, they would keep somebody who had malaria on the unit to inject malaria into people who that they said had schizophrenia, had syphilis.
The Dark Ages. Dark ages. I really believe that probably when people look back, 50 years from now, they're going to say some of the interventions that we use today, they're going to say that it's the Dark Ages, too. They'll be like, we talk now about bloodletting. Oh, I just can't believe that, George Washington died because they bled him to death. And they're going to say the same thing about some of the chemical stuff that's going to be done. They're going to say, I can't believe in the late 20th century, in the 21st century, that they gave these people these toxic chemicals. You know,
it really is. There's a book that was written by a guy named William Trull in 1891. It's called Madhouses of America. And he had been a lawyer, and then they locked him up and said he was insane. And he was in multiple different institutions in a couple of different places, but a few of them were in New York State, the Utica State Lunatic Asylum and other places. So he wrote that, you know, they were going to look back at his time and call his time the black of the dark ages. Mm-hmm. And we do look back at it. And yet, when you look at what he wrote about in 1891, and you do a comparison of, like, the amounts of people and all the things, it's still the same. And absolutely, 100 years from now, people are going to say how barbaric that they treated people in these ways. And hopefully it won't take 100 years. And hopefully what they're doing isn't going to be even worse.
Well, it hasn't been long because I remember when first time I went over to St. Elizabeth, like in the mid-90s, and we were trying to design a new system, and that was when they still had, like, lots of people. Now there's only, like, 250 people. And, you know, the people that had that blank stare from, you know, the people that had the lobotomies and the, we used to call it the Haldol shuffle. I mean,
right.
They still, and that was in the 90s. So, you know, you still had plenty of people who had, you know, been over there for, you know, decades on the back wards that were like that. So, you know, there's still people around. A few people that survived that kind of insane, and I really think it's insane the way that they were treated. But there are still people that survived. So it's still recent history. Because the only thing they did replace the lobotomies with chemicals that do the same thing, that, you know, just eat people's ability to have cognitive functioning, to be able to, as someone said about the ECT, they rob people of their careers.
Right. Well, yeah, people's memory, people's lives, and this torture and crimes against humanity in deepest ways imaginable. And you said that you went to St. Elizabeth Museum. I didn't know they had a museum there.
As you go in, they got a little place, and for the public, it's like a little room. And I think that if people come to Washington, they should go to it just because they should make comments, because they sanitized it so much. I mean, like, they had stuff about, you know, the stuff they had in the chapel. They have the dishes of the superintendent of the hospital. They have how they had the little, I guess, the uniforms and the shoes that they had. They got some dishes to somebody who was there from, I think, Japan or China, who was really helped, and they gave something to the hospital as far as these dishes back in 1890-something. But it's really kind of sanitized. It really isn't like our history. You know, it's good that there's somebody that a person who's a current resident that can do it. They only are open Tuesday through Thursday, 4 to 6. I think all these places that if they have museums and you live in this place or visiting, I think we should go to them. And if they have a book to make comment, you should make comment, because I know at least in St. Elizabeth, it looks like they really sterilized it. There's something like St. Elizabeth, a lot of people don't know, they had a bowling alley. They had cows. They had their own dairy because they had, like, thousands of people, like 6,000 people that were there. It was a little city.
That was what asylums were. Like, if you were a doctor or a nurse or anybody, you lived there. They were self-sustaining cities, and they were developed to get us the hell out of the rest of the thing. You know what I mean? This was the beginning of the othering, of where they created these self-sustaining little cities in order to keep us out of the public. And they kept, you know, like I know like in the Utica State Lunatic Asylum, they kept really detailed records about all of the money and that they wound up, making money from selling vegetables and fruit and meat and, you know, like in dairy. It's like it was a business there, and the inmates worked the fields and the printing presses and all the other things. And
they had a greenhouse. In St. Elizabeth, they had cottages, because early on when I was doing rap groups, one of the early rap groups that I did was kind of midway. It was at what they called the cottages. We had cottages down there, and this was like in the late 90s. They had cottages in the, well, early 2000s. They had cottages where they had, for example, they had people who were hearing impaired, because in Washington we have Gallaudet. And, today is, I remember this a couple of years ago telling someone, we had someone on the ward and all they can do is sign. I say, they're in isolation. But they had a dedicated ward for people who were deaf. That was because the community, the Gallaudet community, Gallaudet is a university for people who are deaf. It's a large university in Washington. They required to have a unit for deaf. Now, I think that there may be one or two deaf people at the hospital, but they had an entire ward for deaf. They had a cottage. So if I would go there to,
come
back because... Yeah, it was huge.
Oh, I don't know.
And it hasn't been that long ago.
I think that, you know, when you look at what these places were like when they were, warehousing thousands and thousands of people and hundreds of thousands, what was it, in like 1955, there were over 500,000 people in the United States locked up in mental institutions, right? And so...
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're just, but, you know, something you said, Iman, about, like, that it was sterilized and that they didn't have our story, like, they have stuff, but they didn't have our story, that's what I feel like the Florida Psychiatric Museum, and what I'm hoping that I'm going to be able to, sell them on having an exhibit based on, the history of the psychiatric survivor movement, and having that incorporated all the way back to the 19th century lunatic liberation movement, so that it's,
They really sterilized. They even wrote a. I had tried to get permission to record people to do like an oral history project. I had asked the head of the hospital, who is still the same head of the hospital, but they had someone do it. I guess it was a government printing office or whatever, and they actually have. And, in fact, I look on my hard drive for it. If I'm not, I can get it from someone else. I'll send it to you. But it was more like about the buildings and things. Even now in the new hospital, they named, different – they don't have wards. They call them houses, like in the Harry Potter type of book. But they're named after, like, people that, psychiatrists. There's a labyrinth that's named after, like a walkway that's named after – a consumer advocate that's there, but it's really very sterilized. In the old buildings, which are still on the hospital ground, which I would prefer to see that as a hospital, they do have things, because before they built the new hospital, you'd go into buildings and you would see the cages where they kept people in. The large, where I did, was doing groups, because the new hospital is only 3 years old, is in the large day rooms. In a lot of ways, the newer hospitals are not really a good place. The old hospital had large, enclosed porches where people could go outside. Now the large buildings, have a lot of brick. They just have a small window in their room. You know, it's not as open as the open spaces that they had in the older buildings where they had large day rooms. Now, things are very small, even in the rooms where they have groups and things. They're very tiny, almost claustrophobic. They have large hallways, but the places the people live are very contained. They have pods. You know, staff talk about they like having the, because they have video. So even when we have patient government at the hospital, which I go to some of the things they have every month, there is the ability that they can be observed. So at all times, people, they have the ability to observe people. You know, I mean, it's cleaner hospital because the old buildings that they had, truly, they didn't have, in some places they didn't have heat. And this is like 3 or 4 years ago. They didn't have heat in the winter, didn't have air conditioning in the summer. You know, they had these old buildings were a couple of hundred years old. Architecturally, they're very beautiful. You know, and that's what they talk about in the history. They talk more about the buildings. They have the furniture that the superintendent had and stuff like that. They had lots of artwork and stuff that, you know, I think has been destroyed. They have a resident photographer that's taken lots of pictures. I'm thinking about where is this stuff at, because it's a treasure trove of stuff, because that hospital was there since the Civil War.
I think that's the... What's that?
Go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to say, like, you know, when you look back to the 19th century, Thomas Kirkbride, and he was the architect who was in charge of building this model and worked with Frederick Olmsted, the architect landscaper. And so some of the things that they said, like, were necessary were large rooms with big windows that looked out over lots of green space. And, you know, that part of what became, like, these hallowed halls was really, at first, an attempt for people to be able to have a sense of space and privacy and territory, and to prevent the crowding, because the almshouses were so overcrowded. So, of course, the asylums wound up just becoming warehouses and overcrowded and horrible places, too. So that's part of the problem, is when you institutionalize things. But, you know, that's the design of these places was so intentional, and they had these huge committees, you know, back in the 1830s or early 1830s of where they came forward. And in the 1851 edition of the Journal of Insanity, which is today's American Journal of Psychiatry, the Kirkbride report was in there about what these places should look like and how people should be cared for, and that they should be beautiful places and people should feel like they have worth based on the buildings that they were in. And of course, that all fell apart so quickly. And so I just want to, you know, if anybody's out there, what's that?
If anybody's out there, yeah, they should call in, especially if they, you know, have been in these places or been to any of the museums or can recant about the largesse of these asylums. I don't want to sound nostalgic about it, but you're right. St. Elizabeth's campus, which has been, I guess I call it being raped, because Homeland Security is on one part, because there's actually an avenue, it used to be Nichols Avenue, now it's Martin Luther King Avenue, that goes straight down the street on one side. Now Homeland Security has it, and on the other side is where the hospital is, but even where the hospital is, they have encroached. In fact, encroached on this area. At one time, one of the many people wanted to go would come to the campus who were not there to visit people because of the beautiful views. There's a place called the Overlook, which has one of the most fantastic, beautiful views of the District of Columbia. And it traditionally, a lot of the residents of the hospital and their families would go there during the 4th of July because you could see a display. They do today have concerts at St. Elizabeth's campus that is open to the public and that the resident privileges go to. And why I say have privileges is means that people from the outside can come over there but to the concert, but there are some people who don't have privileges, ground privileges. They can't go there. They actually have movies on the campus. We don't have, in the area where the St. Elizabeth lives, where St. Elizabeth is housed, is the area they call Ward 8 Anacostia. About 70,000 people, including myself, live there, but we don't have a movie theater. But at the hospital, they have a place where at least once a month in a 250-seat auditorium that they show a movie there. But, you know, it was a grand place. It still has lots of green areas, although most of those green areas, unless the residents have city privileges, they don't have access to. They have built a new performing arts type place on one part of the campus now that most of the residents don't have use of. A lot of this is large spaces of land that now, and I think that Elizabeth is not the only place that does this. There are a lot of places where golf courses and other things have been are now the places where some of our peers used to walk.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is just, you know, to really be able to talk about our history, to really be able to talk about our history in this way, that it has such a significance to be able to you know, understand how we got to where we are now, because they were not always like this with us. Can you still hear me, Ivan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I mean, I think that there's this real you know, desire to try to sanitize the whole story out and to not have. I mean, obviously now they try to sanitize everything, and I think that that's a really good word that you threw out there for that. But even in historical terms, that our story doesn't really necessarily get into any of these places. And so that's my real goal for going to the Bloor Psychiatric Museum and trying to get that you know, paid attention to, and to have our story validated inside of that that kind of experience.
It's before those things get wiped away. It's like I compare it to. I went in Georgia. I went to Eagle Landing. It's a place where anybody has seen the movie Daughters of the Dust. It's about a area in Georgia, like near the Sea Islands, where black people were, like after the Civil War. It's like that. It's like they're wiping out a part of the history. And these places, if you can see the history, you can see that when pharmaceuticals got good, things changed, because at one time they considered like St. Elizabeth to be the state of the art. They had things like people would talk about, they'd go there to rest. Like they had art therapy, you know, they had dance therapy and stuff like that that people went. I think also the place in Massachusetts, McLean Hospital, was sort of like
sure.
That. In other words, all of these things, you know, like Van Gogh, you know, when he went to asylums in France, you know, that's what he did a lot of his great work. You know, people went there, they had these green areas that were there. I mean, truly a lot of horrific things did happen because they had people stacked deep on the wards. And you can still get, you know, pictures of these places, because you can just imagine people lined up for you on a ward where they just had, you know, where you in a room where they had 50 or 100 people. So, in a sense, it is different now that they don't have that, but they had, you know, had all of these people that were there. So these were, so these places were big cities. They had thousands of people on there. Staff lived in the place. I think that Darby Penny's book that she co-authored with, I can't remember his name now. But,
with Peter Stasny. The Lives They Left Behind.
Yeah, I wish that Darby would, if she was listening on the phone, that she would come on the show sometime and give a little historical about the Willard Hospital, because, you know, I really love that book that she had, and I've given that book, assigned copies to some people at the hospital as well, some of the people there, because they have sanitized it. They make it all about the treatment, not about the life of the people and, you know, what, like the lives that, like you said, the lives that people left behind. And, you know, what it was, and, you know, one guy in a book was a grave digger, and he was there until he was in his 90s, you know, someone who was a World War II veteran. And we have some video diaries of people at St. Elizabeth, the same thing there. Now, people, they say all the time when I go to meetings, they say, Vaughn, we don't have people there. I said, yes, you do have people that have been there 30, 40, 50 years that are still there at the hospital. You know, occasionally they will outplace people to a nursing home, but they come back. And I'm always, there's nothing very much we can do except for try to find other places for people. But, you know, when someone says, well, you know, I was happy, I was at, you know, even though I can't be happy, they were at a nursing home and they brought me back. You know, and you can look at the person, you see why they brought them back. Was not because they were getting worse. It was because maybe they're now in a wheelchair or something, and they bring them back. Our hospital, for many years, I considered to be a dumping ground, because people inappropriately, and some of those people are still stuck. They, you know, because they had Alzheimer's or whatever else, this was the place where you know drop people off, and as Maria said, not Maria, Angela said, and Maria said the night before, once you get that label, you get stuck. It's so hard to get unstuck from that label.
And this is where the problems come in, and so how do you change that societal attitude when we're up against laws like HR 3717 and the media spouting this falsities about the continued disenfranchisement of us as a people. If you'd like to call in and talk about this or anything else, the number to call is area code 267-521-0167. It's area code 267-521-0167. And the toll-free line is
855-346-3351.
Okay, that's wonderful. Yeah, but, you know, more and more that you talk about this, Lauren, that, you know, it's become evident that you really have to tax the character itself, because it's just like, It's like tar. They get stuck on the person, no matter if something is a situational thing or not. And you either have people saying that, you know, that you look, this is what you're going to have, and you're like this for the rest of your life. And then other people that will say, when the people that really had some horrific time, they'll say, well, your emotional distress was not real. You know, so... I just wish that we could get, people could get the support they needed without having to take on a label. You know, it's all about, you know, I guess getting people getting paid. You know, if someone needs assistance or help, you know, and they're having difficulty in life, why do we have to sort and categorize them and put a mark on them like you're branding them for the rest of their life, you know, that because you're having a difficult time, your emotional distress that you're having is real. You know, the traumatic events, the things that happen to you are real, but why is it that even after the person has gotten their life back, I shouldn't say getting their life, but restitution and recovery are two different things, but why is it that you still got to be burdened with, like someone said to me, well, don't you have a problem? You know, so it's just a two-way thing, and this expansion of Murphy Bill and all the other bills and all the things about categorizing people and sorting people, you know, I have nightmares at night about, you know, that, you know, people are in line and they're sorting people according to, you know, labels and diagnosis. You go to the left, you go to the right, whatever else. And, you know, the way they have it now is like almost everybody, every human behavior must be explained by the DSM-5 now. There's probably no one on this earth who could not, if they looked at the DSM, they couldn't find anything. They could not say that they had some kind of order or disorder. I mean,
and that's their goal. That's their goal, to have a world domination and have everybody on drugs and everybody. I mean, Ivan, it must have been early 2000s. I sat in meetings with bigwig state people who said that their goal was to get everybody a label because that would eliminate the discrimination. So if everybody was psychiatrically labeled, then there would be no more, quote-unquote, stigma. And I remember that being one of my final lines before I finally left working with the state. But this is their... you know, their big plan.
Listen.
Like, you know how McDonald's has the 5-minute plan where, you know, from wherever you are, that you can get to a McDonald's in 5 minutes or less? Like, this is their business plan. This is a business. And they have every intention of having people entirely, you know, and the DSM is expansive. I absolutely agree with you. There's no way that somebody cannot walk away with a psychiatric label if you read that book.
It's worse than that, because the thing about it is that, so that's like saying a person is blonde, brunette, and got the eyes, but it's worse than that, is that I just hate this, and I don't want to, like I said, I feel like Harry Potter now, he who should not be named, but that organization that is putting forth this, they make it as if that there's a plague on the land, that there are people, you know, I wish that they would do as much for a psychiatrically do as much for people who have HIV and hepatitis as they would do with people that are psychiatrically labeled. Because it's like there's a plague on the land. There are these people who don't know that they are sick. And we've got to find them out. We have to put in. So every doctor will screen. Every teacher in the school will look out. I mean, if we had this kind of thing for HIV, for cancer, I mean, we don't have that kind of, it's like, you know, we've got to go and find this, you know. Every
well,
kind
no,
of behavior. I mean, that's
those
article.
That can actually... they wouldn't be able to do it with something like HIV or with cancer, because those are things that can actually be tested and demonstrated. The only reason that this works is because there's no way to actually prove that any of this exists, and their proof for it existing is the person who's being charged with it denying it. And so it's quite the scheme, but that's why it works, because if it was something that could actually be tested for and proven to exist, they would never pile the resources into it like that. They just wouldn't.
Okay, I'm gonna be the devil's advocate right here now. But Lauren, this is a real illness. It's biological.
Well, no, it's just a fraud.
That switches in the brain, you know, the serotonin level, and we can see the cortisol on the brain scan.
And it's all been rebuked. I mean, I think that anybody who's thinking that needs to go read Robert Whitaker's Anatomy of an Epidemic. You need to go read the National Institute of Mental Health website, the National Institute of Health website, that there is no known etiology of this. There is no blood test. There is no brain scan. There is no genetic scan that can show that any of this exists. They want it to. They're going to put millions and billions of dollars into trying to find it, but that is not legitimate. And when people argue that they're going to start using the language of mental illness again because those who are in power, like Murphy, are saying that the problem is that they're not using the language, and so that they're going to start talking about like how they're mentally ill again after all of these decades of people trying to get this concept outrooted, it's just criminal as far as I'm concerned. Especially because they're admitting that they're doing it for the money.
Well, when people get confronted with it, they do back down. Because I have seen this happen. I went to the secret conference they had for the courts here about 2 or 3 years ago. I know they probably still have it. I just haven't found out where it was. I guess maybe I was so disruptive. Well, I wasn't disruptive enough. They carted me out. But and virtually the presenter said, don't go into court and bring brain scans, because I turned to the audience and I said, when I got the question, I said, now, how many of the people that you have here that come before you in the courts? And we were talking, I'm talking about at least 1,000 people. They were judges and other officers of the court from around the metropolitan region. I said, now, how many of the people you see have these brain scans? And that's always the question for me is, if the brain scan is proof, because they always do it when you go to a NAMI conference or something, they always show these brain scans. I think these brain scans are proof of it. I would think that everybody would have a brain scan, and every so often they would give you a brain scan to monitor that. But I don't see that as being the standard diagnostic tool of anybody.
Right.
So it's all observation. It's all subjective.
You're being really bad at being a devil's advocate. You're not doing the devil any favors yet. I wanted to say area code 503. Your line is open.
Hi, Lauren. It's Deborah.
Hey, Deborah. How are you?
Hey there.
You're
good.
On with myself and Yvonne.
Hi, Yvonne. I was just going to say this morning on Good Morning America, they had a special broadcast, growing patient population now with a diagnosis for ADHD is women between the ages of 25 and 35.
The ADHD that the doc who on his deathbed said that he made the whole thing up?
ADHD.
Yeah, the attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
Right.
The doctor on his deathbed, the doctor who coined that, he admitted that it was all a fraud and that he made it up and that it wasn't real. So 25 to 35 year old women, huh?
Right.
And what are they getting? What are they getting? Speed?
What are they getting? What?
Speed? Are they getting Adderall or whatever?
Ritalin and Adderall.
Yeah, Schedule II drugs, same as cocaine.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Freud would be happy. Freud would be thrilled. This was what Freud wanted. He wanted everybody on speed. He wanted everybody on cocaine. I want to talk more about
this. Well, you know something? I speak to this because I have experience with that particular situation. There's 80% of people in the United States have a magnesium deficiency. And some of the things that appear to be like ADHD are really like vitamin deficiencies or people with hearing problems. I was a person with who did not speak until I was 5 years old. And I'm saying this, that we don't, the physical doctors and the psychiatrists don't do their profession any good because they don't look at all the other things. They just want to rush to these diagnoses because we didn't have, you know, 30 years ago, we didn't have all these people with all these different childhood maladies or even adults with that. We didn't have all that. So, you know, some of these things have to do with the fact that we're not only being bombarded by chemicals, but we have stuff in our food, too. Because, you know, after World War II, Mom went to work, and they had convenience food, so they got all this salt and stuff in it. And in my class, every day I'd be telling people, don't, you know, they come in with potato chips and sausage. You're frying your brain. You're priming your, I see pregnant mother, you're priming your child for hypertension. And, you know, no wonder they're bouncing off the wall. So, you know, they're not exploring.
Right.
It's very easy to, you know, it's very easy to give a pill versus to tell someone that, you know, your life is chaotic. You know, you're
right.
You're
I want to bring in, yeah. I'm right there with you, Iman. I just want to bring in area code 803. Your line is
go
open.
Ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yeah.
Hello, can you hear me? This is Gareth in South Carolina. Hi.
Hey, how are you, Gareth?
I'm
doing good. What would you like to talk about?
Thanks for inviting me back to the show. I noticed that a while back you were talking about the some group of people, their goal is to get world domination and everybody on drugs. And I'm just wondering, when you say they, who are you talking about?
Well, I think that I'm not going to speak for Lauren, but I can say that what we're talking about, she didn't say world domination, but there is, if you watch TV and listen to everything, that there's an industry that benefits from having this. If you notice on television, for example, they'll talk about you being shy and you're not being able to perform at work, and that they have that you should ask your doctor about a particular medication or chemical. And I don't want to speak for Lauren, but I think that that's what we're talking about. In other words, that you know people there's a quick fix whether you're
I may have said world domination. I may have said that they want everybody in the world on drugs and that is part of their business plan. And who I'm talking about when I say they is the government, the psychiatric industry, the American Psychiatric Association, the World Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association. I mean, there is an organized psychiatric industry that continues to grow itself, continues to publish manuals that are ever expanding with a further reach. And the day that I was speaking of specifically when I said that their goal was to diagnose everybody were the senior level staff of the Bureau of Children and Families, of the Commissioners of Children and Families of the New York State Office of Mental Health, where I sat in meetings where they talked about the plans to get as many young people diagnosed as possible as a way of eliminating stigma and discrimination. And that was in the 2000s. But this larger, Gareth, this larger organized psychiatric industry is very, very real, and they do have their sights on having as many people under social control and on drugs as they possibly can. And that is well evidenced in the DSM-5.
Well, I guess the reason why I asked the question is, has to do with sort of the ultimate motives and goals of these people who fall into the category of the organized government and psychiatric and psychological industries. I guess through my experiences anyway, a lot of the individual people involved have benign motives and that their own personal goals are to help people, you know, whether they do it in a way that, that's right or wrong is beside the point, but their own goals are not world domination and social control. So I guess I can certainly believe that there are, you know, some individuals and even organizations that have a goal of world domination and social control. I mean, I know Dick Cheney does, but, you know, there's millions or maybe billions of people involved in this massive industry you're talking about, and I just can't believe they're all in on a big conspiracy.
Well, Garrett, what we're trying to say is, and I will speak for myself, is that, for example, when people have emotional distress or they have something that happens in their life where they don't act according to what is socially acceptable, the first line that people look at is that the person should be taking some chemicals. Oftentimes, you will see, they will say, oh, the person went off their medication. They had a story that was Sunday's Washington Post.
Hello?
Divorce. You still there? The person
I'm
that got
here.
Divorced.
Are you still there? Come back, Yvonne.
You still there?
Yep.
Yeah, well, and the fact was that the person wasn't bothering anybody. You know, of course his behavior was, he was drawn from his family and stuff. But the thing is that people have added that to the fact that the person, to force the person to take medication. You can't deny the fact that all over the television, there's people have gone directly. No longer do they go directly to the doctor to tell about the drug. They go to the customer. They come to us and say, look, you're having a hard time in your social life. You don't have a girlfriend. You feel sad, whatever else. And they have these kind of things, just as some people talk about the moral climate in the country. The same thing is they're saying they have to expand their customer base. And what they do is they go directly to us, and also they have other people who say that there are all these people out here who don't know that they're sick, and we have something for them if they would just take the medicine, if they would just take the pill, that they would be okay. And so that's what I'm talking about. I know what, and I think that that is probably the same thing. In other words, they're thinking that, you know, a little bit of Prozac could almost help everybody. So if you have a DSM, if you have the Bible, which is a DSM-5, and if almost everybody can be categorized in some category, and they're saying that the first line of defense, if everyone has some illness, is some kind of chemical, then that really is saying that they want to expand their customer base. Now, whether it's world domination or not, you know, that's another issue. But they do want to expand. If they do testing and whatever else, according to the DSM-5, there's nobody who would not fit into one of those categories. There's some of the same things that someone like E. Fulatori is against. They're saying that people aren't taking people who have very serious mental illnesses serious because, you know, this thing has broadened out, but it's to their benefit because everyone, nobody would escape. No one would escape having a psychiatric label according to the DSM-5.
I think it's, you know, like even like with Deborah, I know Deborah, are you still there? The idea that, you know, the attention deficit hyperactivity disorder being the new growing diagnosis for women 25 to 35 years old, there is just an overreach of this thing. And I don't think that all people who work in the psychiatric professions are evil or part of this design. I think some of them are as much a slave as we are, but they also have a responsibility. And in 2014, to not be aware of the damage that you and your profession are doing, or to deny that, it should be grounds for the people losing their license here, as far as I'm.
Gareth, you still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening.
Okay, what you say then?
Well,
we know that people. Some people have drunk the Kool-Aid. They believe what they're saying. I know that. They're well. They're people that believe what they say.
I was going to say thanks for the opportunity to share some thoughts with you. I guess my question has to do with the goals and motives of these millions or maybe thousands or hundreds of thousands. I don't know how many people are involved.
Well, they're indoctrinated. They're indoctrinated, Gareth. So, they may go in with, the idea that they're going to be helping people, but within, weeks, they're anything that they've been told about anything is wiped out, and they're given this new mantra based on a fraud. I'm a psychology professor, and so I watch these young people come in as Psych 100 students, all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, wanting to help the world, and by the time these same students are seniors, they're, trying to figure out what's the best way to get prescribing privileges for psychologists. And the things that horrified them, 4 years prior, now having been through 4 years of indoctrination in an undergrad psychology program, a room full of freshmen, you show them something like what happened at the Judge Rottenberg Center with the shocking of the child, they're horrified. A room full of seniors have 1,000 reasons of why that's a legitimate action. They're literally, brainwashed into thinking that what they're doing is legitimate and necessary and beneficial and benevolent. And they're lied to. And then their lies create more lies. I was in court the other day watching, this horrific, sham that there's some kind of justice to be served somewhere. And, when I questioned why, at no point was the validity of the, psychiatric diagnosis challenged, I was told that that would be a political statement, not a defense. And so, everybody is playing along, and everybody is part of this problem as to why Murphy can then get away with putting forward the kind of crap that he puts forward in H.R. 3717, for example.
It's like the little boy that said, the emperor, he has no clothes.
These are all really compelling things to say. I believe they're all very compelling. I just don't personally believe that that there's a mass organized goal to dominate the world and get everybody on drugs and it's all a complete fraud and everybody is calculatingly cynical and that it's all a big conspiracy. I just don't believe that.
Oh, then I think you need to read some more.
Well,
seriously, I'm not saying that to be a bitch. I really mean that. I really mean you need to go and I don't know if you've read like Robert Whitaker's book or the other, but that this has been a constructed plan over the last 40 years to grow and swell this field. And to have all of these people, I mean, that's why the TSM keeps on expanding.
I have read Whitaker's books and have met him and had dinner with him and watched him lecture 3 different times. And I've read quite a bit, but of course there's always more to read. But I just don't believe that this is a mass organized fraud.
Well, let me ask you this, Gareth. Why do you think that there's an explosion in the number of people who have mental health diagnoses now? What is the reason for the explosion?
Well, I think Whitaker has a lot to say about it. I think he's got a lot of really important pieces of evidence he's been covered, and the media, the New York Times is constantly publishing journalism on, you know, the problems with diagnosis and this kind of topic discussed at every level. Go ahead.
Why do you personally think that there are so many people now, but we didn't have it before? Why do you think that there's an explosion? Now, why is it, like, you know, his book is an epidemic. Why is there so many people who are applying for disability? So many people, when someone called in a little while ago, I don't know whether you heard it or not, saying that the explosion in ADHD. Why is it all of a sudden we have had over the last 30 years, now we have so many more people that have diagnosis? If it isn't because DSM-5, which even psychiatrists admit in the past they were influenced by the pharmaceutical industry, why isn't there so much of that? I mean, I'm not saying that people don't truly have emotional distress. Not saying that. What happened? What did this? Was there through that? What made it so many people now are sick, if you use those words?
Yeah. Area code 613, your line is open. Guys, stay on the line, please.
Hi, Lauren, how are you?
Good.
Yeah.
What's going on?
I wanted to add it to this conversation because I'm getting a little bit perturbed by, you know, the insinuation, no disrespect that it, I don't believe that psychiatry is a sham. Well, my story can really prove it is not only a sham but a fraud. In 1972, I was 17. I ran away from home because I was being abused at home. I went to the Royal Ottawa Hospital, okay, on my own volition because I was homeless and the shrink said your nerves are bad. I was there for 3 months. And they put me on lots of pills. There's nothing wrong with me at all. I was not on drugs. I was never in jail. I was a good kid. And I ran away from home because my mom was beating me up all the time, okay? So I was homeless. I had nowhere to go. So the school shrink said, go down to the Royal Ottawa, get your appointment, okay? In 18 years, I was psychiatrized
with
four different... Let me finish, please. Hello, I'm there.
Yeah, go ahead.
Am I on or off or?
Hello.
Yeah, no, you're on.
I've been listening to your personal story. Yes.
Lauren, Sue, are you there?
Yes, I'm
here.
Yeah,
Sue. Sue is talking.
I just have to add to this story because I find it okay. To me, for someone who's a torture victim for 18 years, it is a medical fraud. I'm just trying to explain very quickly what happened to me. I can make it very concise. Okay. But I just need a little bit of time, okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
What happened is, okay, like in 18 years, I was shocked. I was given chemical restraints. They pulled me on the floor onto my bed and gave me lots of needles to shut me up because I was not a compliant patient. I said, look at you so-and-sos. I'm going to write about you one day. You're torturing. And the mad person who should be in the hospital is my mother. She's out of her mind. She used to beat me and torture the animals. I won't go into that. I'm not going to go graphic here, okay? But, okay, I went to Brockfield because I tried to hang myself, okay, at the Royal Ottawa Hospital. A nurse saved me. I was hanging myself, okay? Then when I went to Brockfield, they electroshocked me, and I almost died on my fifth electroshock. My heart stopped. I didn't want electroshock. In 18 years, I had 15 different psychiatric diagnoses, from schizophrenic to bipolar to all the way down. I had 14 different types of psychiatric drugs. In 1990, I fired the shrink, and I went cold turkey on my pills. I know I shouldn't have done that. Cold turkey is bad. I didn't have support in my community because they said, you're a psychiatric survivor. We don't have a program for psych drugs. We have a program for street drugs. What's the difference, eh? Anyhow, so that's my story. I'm an activist now, but it is a fraud. They not only tortured me, they maimed my memory. So when I went to university in 95, I couldn't remember what I was learning. Why am I poor? Because I couldn't get an education. I couldn't remember what I was learning. That's all I got to say. I'm clean from psychiatry since 1990. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I appreciate you calling in and saying this,
you know,
because
I have to tell it.
Yeah, and I think it's important that people understand that, you know, if psychiatry wasn't a fraud, you or I or any of these other people who have been free and clear of psychiatry for all these years would be long dead and have been locked up already. I was told that if I stopped taking these drugs, I would be dead and I would be hospitalized and I would be all these other things. And instead, I'm not. And people need to, you know, I mean, and again, coming off these drugs, I did it at a time before the harm reduction guide was created. But they're just as dangerous as street drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, guys, if you're still there, this is a multi-trillion dollar annual industry. This is so much money, so much power, so much influence. And then not to mention the fact that all of these drugs cause all of these other real physical illnesses that then these drug companies are also making tons of money off of, like Eli Lilly with Zyprexa, where the other major drug that they sell is the diabetes test. So they give people the Zyprexa that causes diabetes, and then they're selling the thing to control diabetes. Like, it is so intentional. And again, that there may be some really decent people who work inside of this. I'm never saying that there aren't decent people who are trying, but there is a larger structure here that those people are subjected to the same way we are. And that's real, and it's a real fraud.
It sure is. And Lauren, I'll tell you one more thing, I'm going to go, okay? David Healy, the world's, expert on psychiatric drugs, I used to do the emails with him. He likes electroshock, I don't, so we used to email back and forth, you know, like nicely, but we used to argue. I said, David, I had taken 14 pills. I want you to tell me, about my pills, which ones cause brain damage? He emailed me back, 7 of your pills cause brain damage. So that's what I had to contend with. And also, I call this psychiatric genocide. I know I go on the show every time, Lauren. It must drive you up the wall, but I would say this is psychiatric genocide because they're killing people with psychiatric drugs in the past for 7 years with electroshock and the shocking of the body. I call this psychiatric genocide, and we have to stop it, and that's all I'm going to say tonight. I've done my piece.
Well, thanks for calling in, too.
And thanks, Lauren, and I hope you have a good trip there at the Gore Museum and have a great time.
Thanks
everybody.
Yeah, amazing technology. Talk to you soon, Sue.
I'm going to listen, though. I'm going to listen right on my computer. Thanks, bye. But I'm calling up. But
thanks. So, Gareth, I think these are really hard, overarching questions. If you really, start to pull apart who is benefiting and with what evidence are they doing this and that they still can't produce a drop of actual physical biological evidence for all of these biological, interventions that are torture, half about torture for some people. And again, if somebody with, informed consent who truly has given informed consent and has had a range of options to choose from and all this other stuff, wants to take drugs, take whatever drugs you want. But, let's not confuse the idea here that there's something else going on. Area code 503, your line is open.
Yeah, Lauren and Deborah, I was going to say, I saw something that made me smile today. Do you have positive changes, that chain of for hypnosis for weight loss, out your way?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
But maybe.
Well,
I don't know.
It's big out here on the West Coast, and it's called Positive Changes, and it's hypnosis for weight loss, and that's all you see advertisements for until today. And today they had an advertisement on there showing this girl in her 20s saying that she was going to Positive Changes for anxiety management, and she was encouraging other people her age to try that for anxiety relief. And that gave me some hope in hearing that.
Because it's just hypnosis?
Because it's hypnosis, right.
Right.
Instead of drugs.
Right. And I mean, and I think that there's, you know, I'm never saying that, like, you know, these extreme states don't exist, and God knows that I've had my own multiple emotional extreme things over the course of my life from a very young age, from the time I was, you know, 6 or 7. You know, so, like, I'm never saying that, like, these states aren't real. I'm, you know, and I think that that's another reason why, Yvonne, before you said Darby Penny should come on and talk about the history, and I've been talking with her about this, and about coming on about this trauma-informed peer support, because I think that when we switch the conversation over to alternative ways of healing and getting to, like, actual issues of why people are experiencing these things, then we can get into a different conversation. You know, and even, you know, even in the early 1900s, they knew that what was at the base of the problem were sexual assaults. They just weren't allowed to publish that, so they published a bunch of other crap. But that was part of what was, you know, the divine sellout of all people by psychology. And so, you know, that they take the results in research that they like, and they cherry pick the results that they like, and they push that forward, and they leave everything else covered up, and the FDA allows them to do it. You know, like, I don't know how else to you know, show this, the intentional organization of this, and the intent to defraud people. Tori, for example, and the Treatment Advocacy Center, blatantly saying that, you know, that this is a biological brain disease without evidence, yet having the power behind him with, I feel like TAC is defrauding the public, and that their nonprofit status should be taken away from them. Anyone?
This is Gareth. Can I say something?
Yeah, please.
Oh, thanks. I appreciated all the comments, and I wanted to go back to a question that Yvonne was challenging me with in terms of why all of this incredible explosion of diagnosis and drugs and all this. And I participated in the Occupy movement, and I think that the most important crisis of our time has to do with economic inequality, and I think that basically it has to do with the progression of technology to the point that it's taken away a lot of people's jobs. It's made jobs obsolete and outsourced jobs and eliminated jobs, and so that people are in a massive shift of how technology is affecting our planet and our societies. And I don't think it's so much of an intentional fraud and conspiracy. I think it's an outcome of, you know, huge forces that have done things like cause climate change. You know, is there any one person who, or even a group of people whose goal it was to ruin the atmosphere? No, it was a side effect of technology progressing and a whole lot of people doing a whole lot of individual actions that were not specifically trying to ruin the planet. But I think it's technology and economic oppression, and I don't think that psychiatry can be removed from that whole context. Yeah, that's all I have to say about that.
Obviously, yes, the economics and the economic inequality are major issues, and yes, there's maybe not one person responsible for this, but you can trail back at least till 1903 to show the intentional growth of this field of psychiatry with the intention of causing brain damage in people to control them. You know, now the language in you know, the Journal of Psychiatry, whatever, is generally much more obscured or obfuscated than it was 100 years ago. But there is an intention. There's that they know that part of why these drugs work in sedating and controlling people is because they cause brain damage and that they're chemical lobotomies. And so, like, that's part of the actual psychiatrists who are prescribing this by their licensure should know, right? But they're told that, you know, like the chief medical officer at OMH in New York State says that diabetes is better than psychosis. And so that's what the psychiatrists are, you know, geared to do. And so, is it one person that's responsible for it? No, but there are these entities that are responsible for it, like the American Psychiatric Association, like the pharmaceutical industries, like the World Psychiatric Association, where they all come together in meetings and plan about how they're going to, you know, further expand their reins. That's real. That really happens.
Agreed. These things really happen. I guess where I think I differ is seeing intention in the people who are at the top of these organized psychiatric things. I don't know, the people that you've talked about. Like, I've worked and collaborated with a lot of these people, and you know, a lot of their work may be harming large numbers of people. I just don't think that they themselves are conspiring to perpetrate a fraud intentionally. I think that they sincerely...
Look at Tori, for example. Tori is perpetrating a fraud on the people by saying that this is a biological brain disorder. That is a lie. There is no evidence for that. His goal is to control, socially control, massive amounts of people underneath oppressive laws that almost anybody can wind up falling subject to. Right?
I think Fuller Torrey is a perfect example of how one person can be oppressive and wrongheaded and maybe even evil, maybe conspiring, maybe a fraud, maybe a liar. I mean, I don't know him personally, but I totally oppose him and have for many years. You know, he is an example of one person, but is he an orchestrator of a vast fraud? I don't think so.
Oh, but he is. If you look inside of how this is all working out and how he is and TAC, the Treatment Advocacy Center, is feeding Murphy, and that they're meeting in closed room doors, behind closed doors, coming up with what they're going to push forward. I mean, when you listen to Murphy, you might as well be listening to Tori. It is spoon-fed, you know?
Yeah,
I
agree that Murphy is the captive of Tori and Jaffe's propaganda mill. But I think that the people who oppose Tori and Jaffe and Murphy and their ilk, I think that they, that that I and others would be far more effective if we had an analysis of the situation that didn't accuse the psychiatric organizations and industries of being frauds.
But they are frauds.
Well, I guess you and
it
I disagree about
it's a fraud. If you say, you know, no, we don't have any actual biological evidence of this, but yes, we're going to market it this way that we do, then that's a fraud.
Well, I certainly am not on your show to try to prove anything about whether it's a biological illness or not. I'm not here to talk about that. That's way over my head. I've certainly attended plenty of lectures by people who say it is, but I can't vouch for that because I don't have a degree in advanced bioscience. I don't understand genetics very well and all this other stuff.
But
so
even if you don't understand it, Gareth, the National Institute of Mental Health and the National Institute of Health on their web pages make it very clear that there is no known etiology and that there is no biological evidence for any of this existence.
Well, I don't know about no biological evidence, but I don't know what they say on their website. I know that the etiology is unknown, but let's say, you know, when AIDS first appeared, the etiology was unknown, but AIDS was very real.
It's something that can be measured. And for hundreds of years, they've been trying to figure out how to measure this thing, and there is no measurement for it because it's not something that can be measured. I mean, especially, like, from an Occupy perspective, like, what are we talking about here? We're talking about people who are oppressed, people who are abused, people who are economically disadvantaged, and certainly not any kind of equity. You know, these are the issues. How, when, if somebody is, you know, like with Murphyville, if, you know, the goal is to prevent homelessness, what the hell does psychiatry have to prevent homelessness? But how do you prevent homelessness is you get somebody economic sustainability. And a pill is not going to create economic sustainability.
Well,
and so that's another place.
What they call something called psychiatric rehabilitation, which is now funded by the federal government as being medically appropriate, there are services like supported housing and supported employment
segregation.
And all stuff.
It's segregation. Why are people who are being assigned this label being shuffled off into a segregated housing or employment or education system?
If they're actually following the model to fidelity, they are not segregated. It's integrated competitive employment and integrated community housing.
No, because it is segregated. It's segregated by the whole idea that there's a funding stream specifically for people who have psychiatric history. When there's a housing department that everybody else in the world goes to if they need housing. Where there's an education department that everybody else goes to if they need education. So the idea of a specialized, I mean, this is partially how this system has grown itself the way it has, because it has put itself into needing to be a separate system for every other system that exists in the world, needs to be a segregated system for somebody who has a psychiatric history, where our goal is going to be to get them into the larger mainstream system. But if we wiped out this segregated system of finance and that people who had a psychiatric history would go through Section 8 housing like everybody else instead of having to go through some mental health housing where they're required to take a psychiatric drug in order to have a house,
That's a really good analysis. I really like that analysis. I would point out, though, that if it's true supported housing and supported employment, there are no requirements for compliance with any kind of treatment. If it's true to the model.
Right, but where is it really true to the model? You know what I mean?
But I really like your analysis of talking about the segregated funding, and I think that goes back to a long, long time ago, and when funding was separated, what can I say? It's very cogent. I really like what you said. I just don't think that it's a massive intentional fraud on the basis of individual motives.
Well, I think that if an individual can be a company and a company can have a religion, then the companies need to be held accountable for.
I don't think nobody's going to have a religion. I don't care about
that. Nobody can, Garrett. Didn't you see the Supreme the Justice 7-2 that the company has religious rights?
Yeah, I know.
Right, and it was the predecessor, the preceding vote as to whether or not that vote would even be. So the justices, 7-2, have said that. So anyway, if a company can have rights of the person and religious right, then they also need to take on that liability. Until every single direct marketing commercial, like what Yvonne was talking about before, the idea that these pharmaceutical industries are coming right after us. In other countries, this doesn't happen. They aren't selling us these drugs with the idea that that people know that, you know, that this is gonna that this is known to do this kind of damage to people. I mean, even just the FDA put out a ruling the other day about Big Pharma and Twitter, that they're not going to be able to be advertising over Twitter anymore because Twitter doesn't give enough room to put in all the side effects. And so they're not going to be able to advertise the way they were advertising because of the 140-character limit or whatever the hell it is. But they don't know. And so maybe 10 years ago, because of the work of a lot of advocates, Prozac and all these other people had to start saying that, you know, we think it has something to do with a chemical imbalance or something like that. But they weren't allowed to then put it out as just as truth. But now we know that the whole serotonin, you know, theory was a flop and that the majority of psychiatrists fully admit that they don't have any biological evidence for any of this. And yet, because we live in this drug culture and we live in this society that needs continually commercialize things, and I mean, this is right up Occupy's alley.
Yeah. So where are we disagreeing, and why can't we be more effective in trying to stop the Murphy Bill together? Why is that impossible?
I think that people are working the way that they're working. I think that part of what happened was that instead of stopping the Murphy Bill, they tried to start something else. And I think that's what, you know, where the danger came in. And that's where, you know, now Barbara, who was the absolute wrong person to go to for any kind of support, he got shot by somebody who had a psychiatric history. He is not our friend. He thinks early intervention and identification and all of this stuff is necessary. He supports forced treatment. So going to Barbara as the person who was going to somehow combat Murphy was a bad strategy in the first place. And now you've got, so instead of everybody just focusing on stopping Murphy, the focus went to, well, let's counteract Murphy with something else. And now we've created, or this wound up creating, I didn't, but this wound up creating Murphy and Barbara working together, where they're going to put forward some bipartisan thing around early intervention and identification and screening and all this other stuff. And I think that that's where the real problem came. And I think it's sad because I think it was a big loss. Then we're having to fight two things instead of just having to fight one. And so I think that that's part of what happened.
I think that right now, go ahead.
Well, no, I think that there were a lot of people involved at the beginning, and then a lot of people got shut out of the process, and a very limited funded leadership wound up pushing forward with the idea of what really needed to be restored was SAMHSA. And when you really look at what the Murphy Bill is doing, SAMHSA is just a little tiny part of it. And I don't think it's the most important part of what is going to wind up coming down if this thing passes. And because, you know, Barber and Murphy both don't see force as a controversial issue, and both are supportive of the use of force, I don't think it looks very good, but I think that we need to keep on fighting it.
I agree that we need to keep on fighting and not give up. As far as the Barber as an alternative or maybe a compromise that's going to happen with Murphy or whatever, I think what's going on right now, at least in the United States, is this meltdown, destruction, crumbling of the mental health system or psychiatric system or whatever you want to call it, the force system. And it's not working. Everybody agrees it is not working. And it's causing more problems than it's solving. And so there's like a societal consensus on this from every side. And so something is going to change. Something is going to happen. And Murphy is right now with his sort of synergetic union with Tory. The two of them are very focused and very convincing in their arguments to a lot of people who are desperately seeking an answer and people who are just not willing to believe that it's all fake and a fraud and a conspiracy and a plot to dominate the world. They're looking to someone who has an answer that's more acceptable to their values and worldview. So I feel like if you want to be the player at the table and actually beat the ass of these people, you have to play within the domain of what people in the public are going to accept and rally around.
Yeah, and I disagree. I think that unless there are people who are willing to speak the truth in the harsh language that the truth represents, then we're just going to keep milling around. Because right now, people are willing to compromise on all the values of this movement, that the 40, 50 years of this movement, and to go back and to start re-identifying themselves as mentally ill and pushing medication and moving away from the trauma model and moving away from the expert status of somebody who has lived experience as being valuable. And, you know, quite frankly, I spent a long time putting together this research on slavery and murder and torture and being able to push through a clear and convincing explanation of organized psychiatry dating back to the 1900s. And I am at the table. And I may not be at the table that they're at, but they're the ones that are getting paid. You know what I mean? Like, if you take money from the system, you're going to have to use the language of the system in order to stay working for the system. And I think that as long as there are people on the outside, that's part of what's moving the conversation in a different way. The fact that the people who are in a paid position of leadership in this movement call those of us who are part of the psychiatric survivor movement not credible is a major issue. And I think that it's an assault not only on the individual advocates and activists who for decades have been working in the survivor movement, but I think it winds up becoming an assault on any person who is in the psychiatric system currently or in the future, because it's delegitimizing or it's further legitimizing the professional view that any questioning of psychiatry is evidence of some kind of insanity. And so if the funded leadership isn't willing to put themselves on the line, and, you know, guys, quite frankly, if SAMHSA wasn't on the line, they wouldn't be allowed to be doing any of this. You know what I mean? They would not be allowed to be saying, if this was just about forced treatment, nobody on the national level would be organizing. Nobody would have hired a lobbyist to try to stop this. The only reason all of this action has occurred is because everybody's job is on the line, and SAMHSA's job is on the line. So SAMHSA has given, you know, their grace to allow people to speak out. But if that wasn't the case, none of this would be happening.
Wow. That may be true about people at SAMHSA, but I don't think that people are calling survivors not authentic or not. That's sad.
I was told myself. Harvey Rosenthal, Dan Fisher, there's a whole bunch of them. That I was told that the experience, and if you go trace back on the Murphy page, you'll see these kinds of conversations of where they're saying that the argument of forced psychiatry is not credible, and that the survivor's voice is not, you know, what's needed is credibility, and the anti-psychiatry isn't credible. But anti-psychiatry is the reason these people got their jobs in the first place. You know, when SAMHSA bought out the movement in 1985. And so if the Alternatives Conference wasn't under threat, you can damn be sure that nobody would be putting their job on the line talking about anything publicly. You know, maybe behind the scenes they would be supporting people who were talking out against stuff. But this is a SAMHSA approved kind of pushback, because SAMHSA is under threat. And quite frankly, Garrett, they should be appreciative of the fact that there are people who are survivors of psychiatry who are willing to speak out. Because that counterhacks Murphy's idea that these people are anti-psychiatry. That's the ludicrousness of it. That SAMHSA is anti-psychiatry, or any of these national organizations are anti-psychiatry. What a joke! You know, that's part of the problem, is that anybody who's really got a anti-psychiatry position, including like the anti-psychiatry psychiatrist. You know what I mean? Like, none of them are given any kind of voice, and that's part of the problem, because they fuck up. I'm sorry, whoever you are that mediates the radio station. They screw up the nice idea that there's something good going on here, and never let the facts get in the way of the truth, I guess, or whatever. And I think it's big problems, and I think it winds up pitting individuals against individuals, and that does make us lose some of our humanity. And I think that's sad.
I really appreciate this conversation. You're right about things. Just for myself, I don't know if this makes you feel any better, but I mean, I know about you. I've certainly never met you, but I've read about you, and certainly other survivors and so forth. I don't consider myself a survivor. I'm more of a user. But I'm not a paid leader in psychiatry. I'm selling life insurance right now. And, I'm aware of these things, and I have thoughts about it, and I've tried to stop the Murphy bill in my own little ways. And I'd love to read your dissertation.
Well, thanks. I'm working on getting it out. I wound up using so many long quotes from people because I felt it was important that people saw exactly what was being written, that I wound up having to put an embargo on it, and now I have all these copyright issues that have to be dealt with. But you can read it at, the, I don't know if you're in New York, but you can read it at the Graduate Center. And if you send me an email, I can send you an unofficial copy of it. And that goes to anybody. And my email is laurentenney@aol.com. And I can send out a copy. But I think that you know, when you really start to look at our history and you really start to follow the money and follow how these big, you know, government-sponsored, state-sponsored actions have taken place to grow this industry, it becomes really hard to deny that there's something nefarious going on, despite the fact that there are some really phenomenal individuals who work in the field. And I think that that's where the real trouble happens. And you know, I actually even called the other day, called this psychologist who really, really assisted me, I don't know, maybe 10 years or more ago, got me off all the drugs, you know, like really, 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 really helped me with a total trauma-informed kind of approach. And I said to her, I said, you know, when I'm out there slamming, every now and then I'll mention that, like, there are good people out there. And I do believe there are good people out there. And I believe that even if we don't agree on everything, that there are still places where we can come together and that we can, you know, move an agenda. But I do feel like we need to be really honest about what's happening and that, when particularly when psychiatric survivors are honest about what happened to them and the torture that they experienced, that they're shut down by any of the leadership because they're afraid that it's going to make everybody else seem like they're not credible. And that exact language has been used to me before, and so it's part of the reason why I'm so mad about this thing.
Well, sometimes it's useful to hear what people say about you when you're not around. And, you know, I know that a lot of people would just like to shut down and devoice those who are survivors. On the other hand, there are people like myself who are more of the users who want to reform things. And you might be surprised how often people on my side can feel and say that they are intimidated and devoiced because they are shamed, because they they feel that they can't speak on their own behalf. And I think it happens all the way around on every side.
Well, I think that that's true, and that people are at different places in their life. I mean, and part of, you know, I don't know you, and we have never met, but, you know, part of why I also am so, you know, strong on this idea is because for many years I believed what I was told. I took antipsychotic drugs. I went to hospitals willingly. I bought into the whole thing, hook, line, and sinker. I got marched on stage and was like a good, you know, consumer pony show for many years.
I've had that experience. Had that.
You know, where I really bought it. I really believed it. And it was a big leap of faith for me to. It was both instant. At the mention of somebody saying, well, maybe it doesn't have to be like this forever, George Ebert, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance, being turned on to this other message. But at the same time, it was a huge leap of faith to walk away from the comfort of having some psychiatrist support whatever I did or didn't do in order, you know, in order to really go out and risk failing and falling on my face. And if I didn't take that, you know what I mean? Like, it's been more than a decade that I'm off, like, antipsychotic drugs and stuff like that. And it was a hard transition, but, you know, that's partially why, because they told me that if I ever left, I'd be dead, I wouldn't make it, I'd be hospitalized, that I was making a mistake. And if I believed them, I really do. And if I stayed and I didn't challenge them and I didn't get out of the system, I really believe I would be dead right now. And I really think that I would not have made it as a mental patient for much longer. And so that's partially why I'm doing of trying to, you know, and again, it's about informed consent. I am the last person to challenge anybody about any drug thing.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not about that. But it is about this structure and these laws and the way that the media portrays us. And inside of that, there's a scandal. Okay, we've got about 2 minutes left, but area code 202, Iman, you're back on.
Yeah, I was a true believer, too. I've been listening. I just thought I was in. I wasn't. I was a true believer, too. And my friends are dying. I did. And, you know, we missed the young lady called in to ask about the hypnotism for the weight loss. I mean, there's a lot of other strategies people can use rather than taking medication as the first line of defense. And we just have so many people that are hurting. They have diabetes. The lady that called in last night, I mean, her body has been ravaged. I don't know if you were you on the line yesterday, but if you go to YouTube and just put in Angela Vale and see what happened to this woman. And this is not unusual. I mean, there are about, I don't know, 10-15% of the people that have been high users like that, but you don't have to be on 28 medications. I met someone who was on 99 medications at one time. But you don't have to be on 28. You can be on one or two medications that can blow you up, have you develop diabetes, have you can damage your liver and stuff like that. And I think what we're talking about, I don't think what we're talking about is people don't have informed consent. And they are going to people, telling them that, you know, this is what's going to help you. You need to take this medication. That's the first line of defense. If for some reason something goes wrong, the first thing that people say is, well, people don't take their medication. And that's the first line of defense. And regardless of what it's going to do to the rest of your body, if you have a chance, Garrett, I would go and play this last night's program, because this lady's story, there's a lot of people that have this happen to them. Now, I was a true believer, too, and I'm almost to the point where I'm almost medication-less, and that my doctor was pushing me off of it. You don't need to be. I believe that chemotherapy sometimes helps some people who have cancer, but we don't ask people to be on chemotherapy for the rest of their life. All of these things are very toxic to people, and we do have to speak the truth, because pastors, we give people this false information. They think if the only thing they could do is they take these chemicals, they'll be all right. I was a compliant person when I ended up in the hospital. I was taking my medication faithfully, as a lot of other people are. So that's what we're talking about, and the widespread going about of bagging people in. Maybe there's not somebody sitting in a room and deciding like what Lauren is talking about, but we had people come on the show and say they've been in meetings where they said that the idea is to get as many customers in their individual mental health health departments.
Right.
I mean, there's a snowball, right, man. You can't stop it.
Right. And I think that this is, Garrett, I invite you to come back and talk anytime, and maybe offline we can chat at some point. And, you know, it's taken me 42 years to get to where I am. And I don't expect everybody to have the exact outlook that I have, or even use the kind of language that I get, or use the kind of language that I use. But I sure as hell am going to keep on using it, because I think that we need to call attention to this. I think that when Sue calls it psychiatric genocide, that we need to really take that apart and look at what that means and understand that all of the ways in which it does meet the terms of genocide, and in which the ways that, you know, the special rapporteurs and the United Nations and Convention Against Torture have placed these things in this way. But we do need to keep on fighting the mercy bill, and I will not stop doing that. And I hope you all continue to fight and call your legislators and say no to H.R. 3717. I can't believe that we did this show mobily from the road, hands-free.
I will be on tomorrow night, 9 to 11 Eastern. If you have a tip, you can call the Talk with Kenny tip line at 718-273-8708. Thanks so much for speaking out, and until next time, talk to you soon.